The banners of great houses were draped all around, an array of crests and colors like rainbows after a storm, including the purple and copper of Vernius. Formally replacing the flag that had been taken down and publicly burned after Dominic Vernius had gone renegade. Largest of all was the golden lion banner of House Corino in the center, flanked on either side by the equally large banners of the Spacing Guild and the Moire checkerboard of Choam. Plush, black, and maroon booths held the noblemen, ladies, prime ministers, and ambassadors of all the great houses. Not far from Leto sat the official Atreides delegation, including his concubine Jessica and their new son, only a few weeks old. With them sat Gurney Halleck, Duncan Idaho, Thufir Hawat, and a number of brave Atreides officers and troops. Tesha was there as well, looking at her husband. Romber flexed his new replacement hand, which Dr. Yue had attached, scolding his patient all the while. The accuser's table had been reserved for grim-faced representatives from the savaged houses of Ix, Talagari, Bayakal, and Rachiz. Premier Ein Calamar sat straight-backed, watching the proceedings with his metal replacement eyes, purchased from the Tleilaxu. More widely reviled than ever, as a result of their actions, the Bene Tleilax were not represented at all. The token members of the race who had been at the imperial court seemed to have vanished. Leto did not look forward to hearing the long record of their crimes and moral atrocities, but he could already tell that the hated little men would receive the brunt of blame and punishments. At the first morning bell, the elderly Choam president rose in front of the lectern. During this time of upheaval, many terrible mistakes were made. Others were barely averted. Oddly, neither Baron Harkonnen nor even the official House Harkonnen ambassador was in attendance at the hearings. After the debacle on Arrakis, apparently the Baron had difficulty arranging passage off-world, and his twisted mentat had disappeared from the palace. Leto was sure the Harkonnens had had something to do with at least part of the turmoil. Meanwhile, many rival families crouched here like vultures, hoping to feast upon the fat holdings of Arrakis. But Leto did not doubt that House Harkonnen would keep its fief, though barely. The Baron would be required to pay stiff fines, and had probably placed bribes in the right places. There had already been enough upheavals in the Imperium. For hours the preliminaries were read, with LawTech Mentats reciting long descriptions and summaries from the Imperial Law Code. The questions and charges were extensive. The audience began to grow bored. Finally, Romber was called forward. The cyborg prince stood in full Ixian military uniform, with an officer's cap on his scarred head. He took his position at the podium and locked his mechanical legs into place. After many years of oppression, the Tleilaxu invaders are now gone from my world. We have achieved victory on Ix. The delegates applauded, though none of them had responded to Dominic Vernius's requests for help years ago. I formally request a full reinstatement of Great House privileges for the Vernius family, who were forced by treachery to go renegade. If we are returned to our former role in the Imperium, every house here will benefit. I second that, Leto shouted from his seat at the main table. The throne approves, Shaddam said loudly, unasked. He looked over at Ambassador Pilru, as if they had reached a prior agreement. When none of the other representatives raised any objection, the audience bellowed its approval, passing the measure by acclamation. So noted, the Choam president said, not even bothering to ask for dissenting opinions or further discussion. Romber's scarred face managed a grin, though the restoration of House Vernius was a mere formality, since the prince could never beget an heir. He raised his chin. Before I leave the podium, I believe certain honors are in order. Lifting a rack of colorful medals from the lectern, holding them up to the light, he said, "Would someone step up here and pin all of these on me, please?" The audience laughed, a brief respite from the tension and tedium. "Only a jest." His face grew serious. "Duke Leto Atreides, my faithful friend." Leto walked onto the stage, accompanied by thunderous applause. The rest of the Atreides delegation joined him. Duncan Idaho, Thufir Hawat, Gurney Halleck, and even Jessica, holding her baby. While the Duke stood at attention, beaming with pride, Romber pinned a medal onto the old Duke's jacket, a swimming helix of precious metals, immersed within liquid crystal. He presented similar honors to the Atreides officers, as well as to the long-faithful Ambassador Kamar Pilru. The ambassador also received a posthumous medal for his valiant son, Kater Pilru, as well as for the navigator Demur, who had brought all the passengers of his lost Highliner back to safety. Finally, Romber removed the last medal from the rack and looked at it, perplexed. "Did I forget someone?" Leto took the gleaming award and pinned it on Romber's own chest. Then, in the midst of a cheering din, the two men embraced. From the podium, Leto gazed down at the Emperor. No ruler in the long history of the Imperium had ever suffered such an ignominious defeat. He wondered how Shaddam could possibly survive. But the alternatives were not clear-cut. After so many thousands of years, even political rivals would not lightly abandon stability in the Imperium. And no faction had clear support. Leto had no idea how the hearings would turn out. Finally, Shaddam IV was called upon to speak in his own defense. The Landsrad Hall fell into uneasy murmurings. Chamberlain Redondo directed an imperial fanfare to play loudly enough to drown out their noise. Showing no uncertainty, holding his head high, the Emperor of the known universe stood, but did not go to the podium. In a voice that was hoarse, probably from days of shouting at his staff, he delivered a scathing speech that blamed the Tleilaxu and his own father for developing the ill-fated artificial spice project. "I do not know why Elrud IX did business with such despicable men, but he was old. Many of you remember how volatile and irrational he became near the end of his life. I deeply regret that I did not discover his mistake sooner. Shaddam claimed he had never fully understood the ramifications and had assigned Sardaukar troops to Ix only to keep the peace. As soon as he learned of the existence of Amal, he had sent his Imperial Spice Minister, Count Hasimir Fenring, to investigate. And Fenring had been held hostage." The Emperor hung his head in a too careful expression of sorrow. "The word of a Corino must mean something after all." Shaddam said all the proper words, though few of the attendees looked as if they believed what he said. Delegates whispered among themselves and shook their heads. "Slippery as a greased slig," Leto heard one of them say. In spite of all the forces aligned against him, Shaddam remained a proud man. He stood on the shoulders of powerful, highly respected ancestors, dating all the way back to the Battle of Corin. His representatives at court had worked behind the scenes to salvage his position, and certain concessions would undoubtedly be granted. Leto stared at the ceiling, his thoughts in turmoil. Old Paulus had always taught him that there were ugly necessities in politics. Coming to a decision, the Duke spoke to the assemblage before returning to the main table, deviating slightly from the agenda. The Choam president frowned, but allowed him to have the floor. "Years ago, at my trial by forfeiture, Emperor Shaddam stepped forward and spoke on my behalf. I find it appropriate to return the favor at this time." Many members of the audience reacted with surprise. "Hear me out. The Emperor, through his ignorance, nearly brought ruin to the Imperium. However, If this assembly were to take rash countermeasures, this could bring even more turmoil and suffering. We must consider the good of the Imperium. We dare not degenerate into chaos, as our civilization did during the interregnum centuries ago. Pausing, Leto locked eyes with the Emperor, whose expression betrayed warring emotions. At this point, the Imperium needs stability more than anything else, or we face the very real risk of civil war. With wiser counsel and strict controls, I believe Shaddam can reassert his prudence and rule with benevolence. Leto stepped around the lectern. Know this. We all owe many obligations to the Imperial House. Every family of the Lansrad must mourn the loss of Shaddam's beautiful wife, Anirul. And I more than most, since the great lady gave her life to protect my newborn child, the heir to House Atreides. He raised his voice to be heard over the crowd. I suggest that the Lansrad and the Guild select many new advisors to assist the Padishah Emperor in his rule from this day forward. Emperor Shaddam Corino IV, do you formally agree to work with the chosen representatives for the good of all people, of all worlds, of all holdings? The beaten ruler knew he had no choice. Rising to his feet, he replied, I accept what is best for the Imperium, as always. He stared at the floor, wishing he could be anywhere but there. I pledge to cooperate fully and learn how to better serve my people. He had to admit a certain grudging admiration for Duke Leto, but it irked him how this Atreides cousin had risen so far, while he, the Emperor of a million worlds, had been forced into this embarrassing position. Duke Leto stepped to the edge of the platform, never removing his gaze from Shaddam, who stood alone in his private area. Leto yanked the jeweled ceremonial knife from his own belt. The Emperor's eyes widened. Leto flipped the knife around and extended it hilt first to Shaddam. More than 2 decades ago, you gave this weapon to me, sire. You supported me when I was falsely accused by the Tleilaxu. Now I believe you have a greater need for it. Take it back, and rule wisely. Think of Atreides' loyalty whenever you look at it. Grudgingly, Shaddam accepted the ceremonial weapon. My time will come again. I do not forget my enemies. The secret worlds of the Bene Tleilax have long been the source of twisted mentats. Their creations have always raised the question of which is more twisted, the mentats or the source. Mentat Handbook. To the Baron Harkonnen, Gidi Prime was beautiful, even in comparison with spectacular Kaitain. Smoky skies turned the sunset into torchlight. The blocky buildings and dramatic statues gave the Harkonnen capital a solid, implacable appearance. The very air, with its odors of industry and crowded population, smelled comforting and familiar. The Baron had never thought to see this place again. Once the ominous highliners and the Emperor's Sardaukar fleet had departed from Arrakis, the desert world had trembled like a kangaroo mouse that had barely escaped a predator. According to the official story from the palace, the Emperor had merely been bluffing, and never actually intended to damage Melange operations. The Baron was not entirely convinced of this, but decided not to speak his mind. Shaddam IV had taken extreme ill-advised actions before, like a petulant child who did not know his limits. Insanity! In his damaged garrison capital, the Baron had slammed around in search of scapegoats. All of his Fremen houseworkers had mysteriously vanished. It had taken him weeks just to get transport back to civilization. Rabban, with a variety of excuses, hadn't been too quick to send a frigate. Shaken by the infuriating Landsrad scrutiny and censures, the uneasy nobleman had fled to Gedi Prime to lick his wounds. Though he had been forced to miss the drawn-out proceedings against the Emperor, he had sent couriers and messages, expressing his outrage at Shaddam's misguided threat to destroy all life on Arrakis, in reaction to a few minor bookkeeping errors. He was skilled at shading truth, at massaging information to make himself look the least culpable. As the de facto Harkonnen ambassador, Peter de Vries should have been on Kytane to take care of such matters. He would have to send gifts quietly to Kytane and act humbled and repentant, hoping the politically hamstrung emperor would choose not to lash out at House Harkonnen. The baron would make amends and pay even more substantial bribes than he'd already expended, probably amounting to all of the spice he had managed to stockpile illegally. But the twisted Mentat had vanished without even bothering to send a message. The baron hated unreliability, especially in an expensive Mentat. During the turmoil following the siege of Arrakis, as well as the revolt on Ix, there must have been ample opportunity for de Vries to kill Duke Leto's woman and their baby. Reports were guarded, but it seemed that, while there had been a brief scuffle shortly after the birth, the Atreides baby was safe and healthy. The baron wanted to wring de Vries's neck, but the Mentat was nowhere to be found. Damn the man! As darkness fell, the fat Harkonnen lord glided on suspensors back inside Harkonnen Keep. He had much to do in preparation for his own legal defense, should Choam pursue the matter of his indiscretions. He wanted to be ready, though he had spoken the words all the Imperium wanted to hear. "I assure you that Melange production will continue as always. The spice will flow." His nephew, Rabban, was no help at all when it came to record-keeping and technicalities. The brute was proficient at bashing skulls together, but nothing that required finesse. Certainly his chosen nickname of Beast did little to foster the image of a judicious statesman or skilled diplomat. In addition, expensive repairs were necessary to rebuild the infrastructure of Arrakis, especially the spaceports and communication systems damaged by the guild embargo. It was also hard to do by himself, and he seethed again, angry that his supposedly loyal Mentat was not there to serve him. Cursing his misfortune, he returned to his private chamber, where slaves had laid out a banquet. Succulent meat dishes, rich pastries, exotic fruits, and the baron's expensive Kirana brandy. He paced, nibbled, and brooded. Since being trapped in bleak Carthag for so many days, unable even to send a transmission or summon a courier, he had felt desperate for the finer things in life. Now he liked to snack all day long, just to reassure himself. He licked frosting off his fingers. His body was soft and perfumed, having been bathed by fine serving boys, oiled and massaged, until finally his tensions were beginning to relax. He was exhausted and sore, weary from the pleasures in which he had immersed himself. Rabban lumbered into the chamber unannounced. Fade Rautha toddled along beside his big brother, wearing an intelligent but mischievous expression on his cherubic face. The beast thought he and the Viscount Mauritani had managed to cover up their bungled attack on Caladan. The baron, though, had learned of it almost immediately, and had kept silent about it. The idea did indeed show a surprising amount of initiative, and might have worked, but he would never want to admit that to his nephew. The beast seemed to have covered his tracks well enough to keep any fallout away from House Harkonnen. And so the baron would keep silent and let his nephew stew about it, worrying that he would be found out. Now Rabban shouted to two slaves who plodded along behind him. They carried a long, bulky package covered in bright wrapping and ribbons. "This way," The Baron will want to open it himself. Hurry up, you fools! With a show of bravado, Rabban yanked the ink-vine whip from a clip at his belt and threatened to lash the slaves. Neither of the tall, bronze-skinned men flinched, though their arms and necks bore bright scars from previous whippings. The Baron looked with disdain at the object, which appeared to be nearly 2 meters long. "What is this? I'm expecting no package." "A gift for you, Uncle, just arrived by courier. There's no marking on the outside." He poked the wrapping with a blunt finger. "You'll have to open it and see who it's from." "I have no intention of opening it." The Baron stepped back warily. "Has it been scanned for explosives?" Rabban made a rude snort. "Of course. For all types of booby traps and poisons. We found nothing. It's completely safe." "Then what is it?" "We couldn't exactly determine that." The Baron took another small step backward, propelled by momentum and the assistance of his suspensors. He had not survived this long without a suspicious nature. "Open it for me, Rabban, but make sure Fade remains well clear of you." He had no intention of losing both heirs in one assassination attempt. Rabban gave his little brother a small shove. Fade stumbled toward the Baron, who snatched the child by the shirt collar and yanked him to safety. Rabban himself kept his distance from the package and snapped to the two slaves. "You heard the Baron. Open it." Fade Rautha wanted to see what was inside and fussed when the Baron held him back. The slaves tore at the packaging. Since they were not allowed to hold knives or any sharp objects, they were forced to use their fingers to break the seals. Remaining where he was, Rabban bellowed, "Well, what is it?" Fade struggled against the Baron's grip. Finally, the fat man released his fingers, letting the toddler make his way to the package that lay torn open on the floor. The child looked inside and laughed. The Baron floated over on his suspensors. Curled up in the box, he saw the mummified body of Peter de Vries, surrounded by metallic moldings that must have prevented scanners from determining exactly what the contents were. His lean face was unmistakable, though his cheeks and eyes were sunken in death. The twisted Mentat's papery lips still showed Sappho stains. "Who sent this?" the Baron roared. Now that the danger seemed to be past, Rabban strutted forward. He bent a molding aside and pried a note from de Vries's stiff fingers. "It's from the witch, Mohiam." He held it in front of his close-set eyes and read slowly, as if even the four words were difficult for him. "Never underestimate us, Baron." Rabban crumpled the note and threw it to the floor. "They killed your Mentat, Uncle." "Thank you for explaining that." The Baron wrenched moldings aside and tipped the box over so that the mummy tumbled out. He then delivered a vicious kick to the body's rib cage. Now, in this most difficult time that required delicate political maneuvers just to ensure the survival of House Harkonnen, he needed a scheming Mentat more than ever. "Peter, how could you be so stupid, so clumsy, as to get yourself killed?" The corpse did not answer. On the other hand, de Vries had begun to outlive his usefulness. He had admittedly been an adequate Mentat, devious and full of sophisticated ideas. But he'd also had a penchant for drugs that distorted his perceptions, and a tendency toward showing too much initiative and acting on his own. The next one would have to be watched more closely. The Baron knew that Tleilaxu had already grown other Golas from the same genetic stock, serial versions of Peter de Vries, fully trained as Mentats and twisted with specialized conditioning. The genetic wizards had known it was only a matter of time before the Baron finally lost his temper and carried out his repeated threats to kill de Vries. "Send a message to the Tleilaxu," he growled. Have them rush me another Mentat. Inevitably, the aristocrat resists his final duty, which is to step aside and vanish into history. Crown Prince Raphael Corino. According to a public proclamation by Emperor Shaddam, the funeral pyre would be more magnificent than any seen before in the Imperium. Lady Anirul's body, swathed in her finest whale fur robes and adorned with worthless replicas of her most expensive jewelry, lay atop a bed of green crystal fragments, like jagged monster teeth made of emeralds. Shaddam stood at the head of the pyre, gazing across the ocean of faces. The sweeping crowd of mourners had gathered from across the Imperium to watch this final farewell to their ruler's wife. The grieving emperor wore regal garments in muted colors to portray an atmosphere of subdued splendor. Feigning sadness, he bowed his head. All of his daughters hovered near the front row of the crowd, by the bier, sniffling and mourning in earnest. Baby Rugi cried at all the right times. Only Irulan stood formal and reserved. This display would pull at the heartstrings of every member of the audience, but Shaddam felt no sorrow at her death. Given time, his wife would have driven him to assassinate her anyway. Trying not to look defeated, he let his mind wander while priests intoned their tedious chants, reading from the Orange Catholic Bible, and going through more ritual than Shaddam had seen during his own coronation or his marriage to this Bene Gesserit witch, whose primary allegiance was not to him. Still, this ceremony was what the populace expected, what they enjoyed in their perverse fashion. And now, shackled with the restraints imposed on him by the hostile Landsrad, Guild, and Choam, Shaddam could not flout any rules. The forms must be obeyed. He had to behave. Those chains would hold him back for years. The sanctions to be imposed against Shaddam had been hotly debated behind closed doors. For a full decade, severe restrictions and controls would be placed on his activities, as prescribed by imperial law. During that time, the Landsrad, the Spacing Guild, and Choam would all have far greater influence in imperial politics and business. Spitefully, he wished he could afford to exile Fenring again, to punish him for the Amal debacle. But after all of the Emperor's own mistakes, which, as the Count reminded him, he never would have made had he obtained Fenring's advice, Shaddam knew that if he had any chance of restoring his power base, he would need the devious intelligence of his longtime friend. Still, he would leave the Count on Arrakis for a while, to let him know his place. At last, the priests finished their droning, and a curtain of silence fell over the assemblage. Rugi cried again, and a nursemaid tried to hush her. Court Chamberlain Redondo and the High Priest waited until Shaddam realized that it was his turn to speak. He had drafted a brief statement, which had been read and approved beforehand by Landsrad magistrates, the President of Choam, and the Guild's primary legate. Though the words were innocuous, they still caught in his throat, an insult to his Imperial Majesty. He spoke with all the gloom he could summon in his voice. My beloved wife Anirul has been stolen from me. Her untimely death will forever leave a scar on my heart, and I can only hope that I will rule the Imperium with compassion and grace hereafter, even without my lady's wise counsel and generous love. Shaddam raised his chin, and his tired green eyes flared with the imperial wrath he had demonstrated so many times. My investigation teams will continue to study the evidence surrounding her violent death. We will not rest until the perpetrator is caught and this plot is unraveled. He glared out at the sea of upturned faces, as if he might spot the murderer among them with a mere glance. Truthfully, he intended to do little to investigate the crime. The kidnapper assassin had vanished, And if he posed no threat to the crown, Shaddam didn't particularly care who had done it. Most of all, he was relieved that the troublesome, meddling witch would no longer interfere with his daily decisions. He would leave her empty throne in place for a few months, out of feigned respect, and then would have it removed and destroyed. The guild and the Landsrad would be pleased that he had followed the approved speech. He finished quickly, in an effort to remove the distaste from his mouth. For now, alas, we have no choice but to endure our grief and carry on, to make the Imperium a better place for all. Beside him, truthsayer Gaius Helen Mohiam stood with her head bowed. Mohiam seemed to know far more about Anirul's murder than anyone had been able to determine, but she refused to divulge her secrets. He didn't press her too closely. Letting his printed copy of the speech flutter to the ground, the emperor nodded to the green-robed high priest of Dur, who in better times had performed Shaddam's coronation. Two acolytes pointed their laser staffs, similar to the one his bastard half-brother Tyros Repha had used to shoot at him during the play. Energy beams lanced out and struck the prismatic emerald crystal shards, heating the controlled ionization fires within them. A column of flame rose in an incandescent blaze. Perfumed smoke spilled through grates around the pyre, finally melting the calm, waxy features of the dead woman. The blazing heat made everyone shield their eyes. The crystal blaze continued to build until the lasers went dim and the pulsing lights faded, leaving only crackling, hissing crystals and a fine film of white ash in the shape of a body. Paying little attention to the emperor, Mohiam watched the cremation of Lady Anirul, who had secretly guided the long-term breeding program through its final stages. The unfortunate death of the Kwisatz mother in this, the final generation of the sisterhood's extended plan, left Mohiam to safeguard Jessica and her new child. The reverend mother was troubled by her daughter's defiance and betrayal, and by the kidnapping of the baby and the murder of Anirul. Too many things were going wrong at a critical time in the breeding program. Still, the baby was safe, and genetics was not a precise science. There was a chance. Maybe this son of Duke Leto Atreides would be the Kwisatz Haderach after all. Or something else entirely. Human comfort is relative. Some would consider a particular environment austere and hellish, while others are pleased to call it home. Planetologist Pardit Kynes, an Arrakis primer. Count Hasimir Fenring stood on an outside deck of his residency at Arrakeen, grasping the rail and gazing out at the weathered buildings of the city. Exiled again. Though he retained his official title as Imperial Spice Minister, he wanted to be any place but here. On the other hand, it was good to be away from the turmoil on Kaitain. In the dirty streets, the day's last few water sellers strode past open doorways, dressed in colorful traditional garb. Their pans and dippers clanged, bells at their waists jingled, and their high voices rose in the familiar haunting cry of Susu-Suk! In the heat of late afternoon, merchants closed their shops and sealed the doors, so they could drink spice coffee in the cool shadows, surrounded by colorful interior hangings. Fenring watched a cloud of dust kicked up by a ground truck that rolled into the city, filled with labeled spice containers for transfer to off-world guild ships. All of the records would pass through the Spice Minister's offices, but he had no intention of scrutinizing them. For the foreseeable future, the Baron Harkonnen would be so unsettled by his near brush with disaster that he would not dare tamper with the official accounting. The Count's willowy wife, Margaret, approached, giving him a comforting smile. She wore a cool, diaphanous gown that wrapped around her skin like an amorous ghost. "It is quite a change from Kaitain," Margaret stroked his hair, and he shivered with desire for her. But this is still a palace of our own. I do not resent being here with you, my love. He ran his fingers along the spiderweb sleeve of her gown. Indeed. In fact, I believe it is safer for us to separate ourselves from the Emperor at this time. Perhaps. For all of the mistakes he has made, I doubt one scapegoat will be sufficient. Shaddam does not grovel well. She took Fenring by the arm and led him back inside and down the vaulted hallway. Diligent Fremen housekeepers, silent as usual, went about their duties circumspectly, averting their blue-within-blue eyes. The Count sniffed as he watched them move from task to task, like mobile secrets. The Count and Lady Fenring paused at a statuette purchased in a town market, a robed, faceless figure. The artist had been Fremen. Thoughtfully, Fenring lifted the piece from its stand and studied the creased, smothering garments of a desert man, captured so well by the sculptor. She gave him a calculating look. House Corino still needs your help. But will Shaddam listen? Fenring replaced the statuette on the table. They walked to the door of the wet plant conservatory he had built for her. Reaching forward, she activated the palm lock and stepped back as it glowed, unsealing the door. The humid smell of mulch and vegetation wafted out, filling Fenring's nostrils. It was an odor he rather liked, since it was so different from the arid desolation of this world. He sighed. Things could be a lot worse for him, and for the Emperor. Shaddam, our Carino lion, needs to lick his wounds for a while and reflect on the mistakes he has made. One day, he will learn to value me. They stepped in among the tall, broad-leafed plants and drooping vines, under diffused light from glow globes hovering near the ceiling. At that moment, mist nozzles turned on like hissing serpents. They floated on suspensors from plant to plant. Moisture sprayed Fenring's face, but he didn't mind. He inhaled a long, deep breath. Count Fenring found a crimson hibiscus blossom, a bright stain of blood-red petals clinging to a vine, and, on impulse, plucked it for her. Lady Margaret sniffed the perfume. "We will make a paradise wherever we are," she said, "even here on Arrakis." The cultural borrowings and interminglings which have brought us to this moment cover vast distances and an enormous span of time. Presented with such an awesome panoply, we can only derive a sense of great movement and powerful currents. Princess Irulan Corino, In My Father's House. The starter Bacchica cradled their son in her arms. The infant was dressed in a tiny Atreides uniform, while Jessica had donned the clothes of a common village woman, a brown and green linen skirt and simple white blouse with short gathered sleeves. Her bronze hair was secured with a clasp made of driftwood and shells. Taking his son in his strong hands, Duke Leto lifted the baby high. "Citizens of Caladan, meet your next ruler, Paul Orestes Atreides." The name had been chosen to honor Leto's father, Paulus, while the middle name, Orestes, commemorated the son of Agamemnon in the house of Atreus, thought to be the forerunner of House Atreides. Jessica looked at him with love and acceptance, smiling at her son and glad he was safe. To the sound of the cheering crowd, Leto and Jessica crossed the stage and stepped down into the gardens, where they mingled with the gathered well-wishers. Visiting only briefly from Ix, Romber stood on a grassy mound with his wife Tesha. Slamming his cyborg hands together, he applauded louder than anyone else. He had left Ambassador Pilru in the underground city to oversee the restoration and reconstruction work, so that the new Ixion Earl and his Bene Gesserit lady could attend this special event. Listening to Duke Leto describe his hopes for his newborn son, Romber remembered something his father Dominic had once told him. No great victory is won without cost. Tessia nuzzled against him. He put his arm around her, but felt very little of her body warmth. It was one of the deficiencies of his cyborg body. He was still growing accustomed to his new hand. On the surface, he was cheerful and upbeat, with his old optimistic personality returning. But in his heart he grieved for everything his family had lost. Now, even though he had cleared the name of his ancestors and reoccupied the Grand Palais, Romber knew he would be the last in the Vernius line. He was resigned to the fact, but this naming ceremony was especially difficult for him. He looked at Tessia, and a gentle smile formed on her mouth, though her sepia eyes revealed uncertainty, and faint lines of concern etched her face.